not calling it quits. I'll keep on working on this. I'm working harder on this. It's playing obvious, it is. Oh, dive, dive into you. Dive into
you. Hi there and welcome. You're listening to the Diving In podcast, brought to you by Virginia Seymour and Louise Jones. This podcast is part of a lifelong conversation between friends about the books we're reading and the issues they make us think about. That also goes for the movies and television we're watching and the podcasts we're currently hooked on. We might even talk about what's in the news and anything else we're diving into this week.
Diving in.
Hello, Lou.
Hello.
Hello, divers. Or should I say, hola.
Hola.
Because we're going to be doing a deep dive into Spain today.
España.
Because we're doing a book club on Don Quixote in the next two episodes for our book club, we just decided to lean right into that and immerse ourselves even more and do an episode on books set in Spain. I just adored Spain when we went. That was our last overseas holiday, in the before times.
Yes.
And it really surprised me how much I loved it. Mm. Like, I knew we were going to have a lovely holiday and I absolutely adored it.
Yes.
Really touched my heart in a way I just did not expect. And I'm really keen to go back.
It's such an easy place to be in.
It was so easy. Yeah, you're right.
Really easy
place. I think I thought it was going to be hard. I thought there would be food that I wouldn't like.
Yeah.
The food was fabulous.
Yeah, fabulous. One of our most recent overseas holidays, which again is not recent, relative, was Barcelona. And I feel the same way. I just found it just a wonderful city, easy city to be in, just loved it.
And you walk along and there's trees with oranges in the street.
I know.
I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that. Yeah. But anyway, I just loved it. So we've got two books today. Did you want to kick off with your first one, Lou?
I'll do The Shadow of the Wind first by Carlos Ruiz Zafón, trying to do my
very Spanish
Spanish pronunciation. So apologies to people who are native Spanish speakers. This was published in Australia by Text Publishing, but it was originally published in the Spanish by Planet Publishing in 2001. And I read it way back, 20 years ago. How is that even possible? It seems far more recent than that. And to my shame, I did not realise there have been three subsequent books.
That's not something to be ashamed of.
Well, I just can't believe that I haven't known that.
He's actually got more than three.
Well, I mean,
in this series.
And The Shadow of the Wind is a gothic, mysterious, and at times foreboding tale set in Barcelona shortly after the Civil War. A young boy, the 10-year-old Daniel Sempere, is growing up with his father because his mother has died of cholera when he was only four. And Daniel's father is one of the many bibliophiles in the city. He's a secondhand and rare book dealer. And there's a group of them. They're a community of men that Daniel is familiar with and spends time with. And the book opens on an auspicious occasion. Daniel's father is taking him to a secret place down some back alleyways in Barcelona. And I love how evocative all the streets and alleyways are. Taking him to the cavernous cemetery of lost books, where books that are out of print have been rescued. And as this is his first visit, Daniel is given the opportunity to select a book, and he chooses The Shadow of the Wind by Julián Carax. And the day he chooses the book, he devours it. He reads it and he devours it, and he immediately wishes to know more about Julián. But he soon discovers that this is the last remaining copy of the book. And this spurs him on to find out more and more about this author. And this is consistent with, I suppose, almost the prophecy of the cemetery that books will possess and transform the reader who rescues them.
Yeah.
It's just magnificent. And it's such a great book for book lovers.
Sure is.
And so against the backdrop of Franco's rule and the sort of ever-present sort of shadowy forces, we go on this adventure with Daniel from about the age 15, as he sort of navigates his teenage years and he becomes a young man, and he's always searching and discovering more and more about Julián Carax. And there's two things that we learn early in the book, which I think I can share. It's believed that Julián Carax was killed in Barcelona before the Civil War. That's the first thing. And the second thing is there is a person lurking who has the name of one of the characters in Julián's book who is also searching for Carax's books and burning them.
Lurking is the word.
It is, isn't it? It's so good. And it's not long before the lines blur between the things that are happening in Daniel's life, the relationships that he's having with friends, and things that he's finding out about Julián as a young man in the pre-Civil War years. And not only are there parallels between Daniel and Julian's lives, but there's also characters from the book, The Shadow of the Wind, that resemble the people, as I say, who've appear in Daniel's life. And it's interesting because he's delving into Julian's life and he's tracking down people who've known him as a child and as a young man, and they all add this sort of dramatic new layer to what Daniel knows of Julián. And it sort of draws Daniel into this web of relationships that threatens to spill, and indeed does spill, into Daniel and his father's lives and for many years going forward. And of course, every person he meets who has known Julián has their own lens and their own prejudices and their own versions of their relationships with Julián. And so perhaps Daniel can't take everything at front value. And in both worlds, there are themes that pervade. In Julián and Daniel's life, family and loyalty are very important, friendship, and there's also the omnipresent, omnipotent forces in both of their lives. And class and status also loom quite large in this book, because Daniel's father is learned, very learned, but he's nevertheless a shopkeeper. He's of the merchant class, and many of his clients and the people that Daniel becomes involved with are actually from wealthy Barcelona families. They are their customers. And Daniel is also being raised in a very male world where women are concerned and girls. With his very fleeting memories of his mother, he's quite shy and naive, and that sort of makes him, I think, easily manipulated, and in fact quite melodramatic as well, you know, in the way that he deals with the women in his life, particularly in his determination to rescue them from some of the predicaments they find themselves in. The book, for me, at times felt quite Dickensian.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's just that there's this cemetery, this sort of labyrinth of alleyways, and it, you know, the gothic feel to the
book.
You
feel like there's fog everywhere.
Yes, you do, don't you?
It's like dark.
It's descending from the page, sort of coming up from the pavements, isn't it? Yes. There's a couple of fabulous characters. There's a homeless man, Fermín, that Daniel rescues and brings home, who has a very colourful past as an anti-Franco resistance fighter. And he's a really good egg, and he's dependable. And he turns out to be very loyal to Daniel and his father. And I've seen him described as Daniel's Sancho, which I thought was rather lovely, that we're going to be doing. We're going to be doing Don Quixote, because, yeah, he's definitely a literary sidekick. There's no question about that. And then there's another merchant in their circle, a watchmaker, who is known and loved and tolerated by his friends, because he steals out of his home at night to dress as a woman and to perform in an underground club.
Yeah,
so there's sort of subversive behaviour in these times, and quite a risky thing to do given that there's an authoritarian regime. And that brings me to the sort of, there's also some archetypal villains in the book. There's a sadistic assassin who is now the head of police in Barcelona, and he has his own menacing agenda. So I can thoroughly recommend this book. I actually enjoyed it more. I really enjoyed it more the second time.
Yeah.
I couldn't possibly go into the plot of this book. It is as labyrinthian as the cave itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. I can't even really remember. I've read it twice, but I can't really even remember all of the twists and turns.
It's just full of twists and turns.
Yeah. Can you remember what era it's set in?
Well, it's just post-Civil War, Spanish Civil War, so 30s. Isn't it 36 is the end of the Spanish Civil War,
I think. So just before, as the outbreak of World War II.
Yeah, so it's Franco still, so it's pre.
Oh, okay,
mind you, Franco was in power for years
He was there for a while. Okay, yeah, so that's it, 30s into the 40s.
Yeah, okay. So it really interesting, Ruiz Zafón is revered in Spain as a national writer, revered.
It was so sad when he died.
I know.
I felt very upset.
Yeah. One other interesting bit of trivia, Robert Graves, the British poet, it's his daughter, Lucia Graves, who translates these books.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, so I thought that was really interesting because they're seamless. They're absolutely beautiful. I'm definitely going to read the third in the four that I really want to read. I should also mention, I think when we did one of our crime series, I reviewed Scott Thoreau's book.
Yes.
And there was the mechanism of a Dessé Machina, the literary device whereby what seems like a hopeless situation is suddenly resolved by an unexpected occurrence.
Yes.
And he uses this device in the Shadow of the Wind.
I'm going to think about that. Yeah.
Some people are quite critical of them because it's sort of a way of wrapping up a book.
It gets you out of a tight corner.
Spot as a rotter, yes. So that's The Shadow of the Wind, Carlos Ruiz Zafón.
And isn't the title so evocative?
I know.
Obviously, the wind can't cast a shadow, but does
it? Yes.
What is it there?
It's superb.
Yeah.
Superb book.
I love it.
What about you? What did you read?
So I decided to...
Excuse the wind, everybody. It might come through on the recording. I'm not sure if it will, but
we do live in one of the windiest cities in the world, so it's about time we had a windy episode. I decided to read The Tales of the Alhambra.
Oh.
And it's by Washington Irving.
Oh, yes.
So Washington Irving was American and he lived from 1783 to 1859. And he wrote lots of short stories. He wrote Rip Van Winkle.
Yes, I wonder.
And he wrote the novel The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And he was the American ambassador to Spain in the 1840s. And he wrote a book about Christopher Columbus. And he wrote another book about the conquest of Granada and in Andalusia. And in 1829, he moved into the Alhambra Palace and lived there in Granada, where he stayed for some months. And my absolutely all-time favourite thing about our trip to Spain was our day where we did a big tour of the Alhambra, and I've got the most beautiful photos, which I'll put up on.
The colours are incredible, aren't they?
And the fountains. I just loved it. So I'm a little bit jealous of him because he lived there for about half a year, I think. Mm. He requested access to the palace, and because of his celebrity status, he was actually allowed to move in. And he's regarded as the first American man of letters.
So he's,
And he's also often called the father of American literature.
Oh, okay.
So that just gives you a bit of an idea about him. And interestingly, he popularised the term Gotham for New York.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And also the term the almighty dollar.
Oh, okay.
And he has lots of other quirky, interesting contributions and influences on American culture
that you probably
don't realise until you sort of look into him a bit more.
Mm.
And someone had recommended, you know, if you loved the Alhambra, you should read this book. So I ordered it, and then it's just sat there because you know, so many books are pressing on me. But it is just the most magical place. So I'm so delighted that we've done this episode because I've actually now had a chance to read this book. So this is a collection of essays, sketches, little stories, fables, and it was published in 1832.
Wow.
And it covers sort of a variety of different stories. There are some myths. There are some real historical events that he's sort of recounting that he's been told about. And it's sort of the book that's credited with reintroducing the Alhambra to Westerners when it came out. And there was a film made based on the book in 1950. I think I haven't seen the film, but now that I've read it, I'd quite like to dig around and find it. The key feature about the Alhambra is that the Moors invaded Spain in 711, Common Era, and they were Arabs and Berbers who came from northern Africa. And they were there in Spain until 1492 when King Boabdil surrendered Granada to the Christians. And that's where that phrase, the last sigh
of the Moors.
Comes in, and Salman Rushdie used it in his novel, which is about India, so I don't know what the link is, but there must be one.
Yes.
And that was during the reign of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. So the big thing about the Moors is that they then introduced all this beautiful architecture and a lot of other cultural things, but for a visitor today, I think the architecture is the big thing that you really notice when you visit that part of Spain, particularly that southern part of Spain. We went to Cordoba and Granada, and it's just everywhere, and it's so beautiful. It's very symmetrical. It's got very distinctive shapes and archways and tiles and colonnades, and there's a beautiful sensibility to it. It's very pleasing to the eye, and it's quite different from the Christian style of decoration. So some of the churches were originally Muslim buildings that have then been turned into Catholic churches, which is just a fascinating mix to go in and see what the Christians did when they came back into control of these Muslim-designed buildings. And I find that whole mix just completely fascinating. So this is the sort of book that you can just sort of dip into and read a little bit and then put it down and read something else, because they're all quite discreet little sort of snippets. One of the chapters talks about the government of Alhambra, you know, the way the actual palace was organised, and the fact that it is actually an ancient fortress and it contained an army of 40,000 men within its precincts, which is...
not inconsiderable.
Yeah. And at one point it fell into ruin, and another point the French blew up parts of it. I mean, I'm just horrified to think the French would do that, but they did. And there's a chapter describing sort of the interior of the whole thing, and he got to sort of poke around and get keys and open up and go into rooms.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, and all the changes that were made by different rulers, and the things like the aqueduct system for the water, because the most beautiful feature for me is all the beautiful fountains and the wells and the design of them all, and they're just so stunning. And to think that this was all designed so long ago and it's all still working is just, to me, so clever. I think my favourite little story that he did was he recounts a legend, and it's called The Legend of the Three Beautiful Princesses. And these princesses were the daughters of the Moorish King Mohammed. And the story starts out with Mohammed, and it tells you the backstory and how he fell in love with his Christian wife, and there was lots of drama around that because he was Muslim. And she came to live with him, and eventually they had three daughters named Zayda, Zoraida and Zorahayda.
Yeah.
And they're incredibly beautiful, and he's very protective of them, and he sends them away, and then when they reach marriageable age, he brings them back. But he becomes very concerned about them and keeps them locked away in the Alhambra Palace in one section of it. But there are three young men doing gardening underneath the windows. I'm not going to say any more, but that just leads on to the most fabulous story.
Trouble brewing.
Yeah. So if you've ever visited the Alhambra or you would like to visit it, and if you're interested in the Moors' influence in Spanish culture and architecture, you might enjoy this. It is quite an old book. I didn't find it hard. You know, it wasn't too florid. I think his writing's quite plain. So I didn't have any problem with understanding. You know, sometimes with really old books, sort of have to go back and start that sentence again. What are they saying? not with this at all. So that was Tales of the Alhambra by Washington Irving.
Oh, I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah. Really glad I can tick that one off.
Yes.
What's your next one, Lou?
Well, I sort of also went back a little bit, and as you know, I'm a huge Hemingway fan, so I decided to do The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway, which was his first book. First novel, I should say. Not he published short stories before this. This was his first novel, published in 1926. I must admit, I didn't know that it was his first.
So this is before the Spanish Civil War.
Yes, correct. This is what you would describe as a Romane Clef, de Clef, or in German, of course, it would be a German Bildungsroman, which is a book that kind of deals with one's formative years. And there's no question that this is most definitely thinly disguised.
Sort of a coming-of-age story.
Yes, well, it's definitely thinly disguised story about Hemingway and his pals.
Okay.
And indeed, the main character of the book, who is a Jake Barnes, and he is the narrator of the book, was initially called Hem in the first manuscript. And that first manuscript, Hemingway sent to F. Scott Fitzgerald, and he offered some criticisms. Evidently, some of them well received and others not so, because I don't believe they remained friends. And the name was also changed. So it's The Sun Also Rises, but it's previously been published as Fiesta. So Jake is living in Paris post-World War I. He is an American expat journalist, but also a veteran of the war.
Of World War I.
World War I.
Okay.
Living in Paris in the frequent company of a number of other American and British expats. His group of friends, essentially, and they include a socialite, the Lady Brett Ashley, a writer, Robert Cohen, a Scottish bankrupt, Michael Campbell, and another travelling American who isn't an expat, he's simply travelling, Bill Gorton, and plenty of others as well, but they're sort of the main crew. And some of this group are, at the outset of the story, living in Paris, not living especially productive lives. They spend copious amounts of time drinking and getting drunk, lurking from bar to bar, not talking about anything especially illuminating. And on a very superficial glance, you could say, well, that's what the book's about, this group of friends.
Right.
But then they decide in summer, which is about halfway through the book, actually. So half of the book is Paris, half of the book is Spain.
Uh-huh.
The men decide they will go to Bayonne in Spain for a fishing trip, and then they will move on to attend the annual fiesta and bullfighting season in Pamplona. And as I mentioned, I think I reviewed Farewell to Arms in episode 23, our
yes,
love letter
you did.
To Italy.
Yeah.
Hemingway's writing is so direct and simple. And although, as I said, superficially, much of the book is taken up with these friends conversing with each other in bars and hotels, it's very dialogue driven. You know, they walk to another bar, they return to their rooms,
gosh.
They wake up with hangovers, repeat. But the absolute genius of this book is what he conveys, not by what is said, but by what is not said. And as I said, Jake is a veteran of the war, as is Bill. And there were many Americans and British and others of their generation, many of them with a level of privilege, who fled their countries post-World War I looking for something. And I think Edith Wharton described them as a lost generation. And that is really the sort of underlying theme of this book. These young men and one woman sort of represent this generation of lost young people who don't really know their place in the world anymore. There's a huge amount of melancholy in this book and sadness. They think they're in search of new moralities, new music, new social codes, but really they're really quite lost. There is a closeness between Lady Ashley, between Brett and Jake, but something is preventing them from becoming more than close friends, which I'm not going to delve into. But as her closest friend, Jake has to witness the interest of other men in Brett. And he is very private and very stoic. And as I say, he doesn't share it with you, but you feel Jake's agony.
Oh,
it's he's just a genius, in my opinion.
Oh, I've got to read this.
The book is so much more about the young men than it is about Lady Brett Ashley. So there's a very strong theme of what it means to be a man. Obviously, their alcoholism and drinking fuels bad behavior. They're cruel to each other. They're aggressive. And they kind of act out their insecurities. As the group comes together again in Spain, they've all come from different directions. There's sort of this heightened level of emotion between them. And I can see now, I mean, I read this a while ago, and then so this is a reread for me. And I can see, I sort of appreciate it now in my current age more than I did when I read it in my 20s. It's quite interesting. I can see that Hemingway's being quite deliberate. You know, Paris in spring is civilized and contained. There's a calmness to it and there's a monotony to their lives. Now they've arrived for a fiesta in Spain and there's this heat and there's color and there's drama. And, you know, depending upon your point of view, there's this ritual, almost sacred status of the bullfight in Spain. Hemingway, as you know, has written a lot about bullfighting. In 1932, he wrote Death in the Afternoon, which is a non-fiction book about the sort of ceremony and traditions of Spanish bullfighting. I read that in my 20s as well. And I remember finding it incredibly hard to read because he kind of traverses, as he does in this book, you know, a potentially dubious line between celebrating this almost religiosity of bullfighting with the appalling record of animal rights. And, you know, I can't comment on the record now of Spain, but I think it's pretty well stated that in the past, Spain had a pretty bad record with animal rights. But it's interesting because the fervour and the drama that builds during a fiesta through the bullfighting and the cult of celebrity around the bullfighters is sort of mirrored.
I knew you were going to say this.
It mirrored
the people
in the drama
around
this group of friends.
I love it. Oh,
and so
that's so clever.
It's really interesting because you could read this quite superficially, as I believe I did in my 20s.
Yeah.
And I have a whole new respect having reread it again now, it's a superb book.
I want to read that because now that I know, or I feel like I have a better overview of the sort of the First World War, the post-First World War, a little bit about Spanish Civil War, Second World War, and then and things like post-traumatic stress and,
yes.
and the,
yes.
the gassing that happened in the First World
yes.
War, but not the Second. So I'm sort of fascinated about this. And also now that we've lived through a pandemic, I'm really fascinated about the social changes
yes.
that happen with
yeah, absolutely.
Big cataclysmic
yeah.
world events.
Yeah.
And what how people respond to those and whether they reach back for comforting things or whether they think this is a chance for change, like, you know, we've got Me Too and Black Lives Matter
yes.
and all sorts of things, you know, the climate emergency and, you know, we're sort of surging forward with other things. I'm sort of fascinated to drill into each. And, of course, Hemingway wasn't British, so
no,
he
no.
wasn't involved in the First World War in the same way that maybe that British guy was.
Yes, Jake is American, but yes, a couple of them, Mike Campbell
so they're is. They've all got different
they have.
Positions,
yes,
haven't they?
They have, and they've all been in different places
yeah,
as well.
Which I find
during the war. So it's fascinating.
Mm.
And yeah, it's fascinating to also place it in the context of Hemingway himself, who on many respects was a privileged,
yeah.
you know, who gets to
yeah.
go and live in Paris and become
yeah.
a writer.
Well, you can picture all those photos of him.
Yes. Yeah.
At the French coffee tables
yes.
with the women with the beautiful outfits.
Yeah.
And I can
so it's
picture
really,
all those photos.
It really is a, but it leaves you feeling quite uneasy.
Yeah.
And I should just mention, because it's a bit of fun, there's actually a cocktail called Death in the Afternoon,
oh.
which of course is his bullfighting book. And it's a mixture of absinthe and champagne,
oh.
of course. And it was created actually by the author. So there was a 1935 cocktail book and it featured recipes from celebrity authors in 1935, which
wow.
is fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
So he created this cocktail with absinthe and champagne. And in the book, Hemingway says, pour one jigger absinthe into a champagne glass, add iced champagne until it attains the proper opalescent milkiness, drink three or five of these slowly.
And I thought he was going to say at the end, and fiesta.
Yes, exactly. So that's Fiesta or The Sun Also Rises by Hemingway.
Fabulous, Lou.
Mm, loved it.
Oh,
loved
we're really
it.
Getting a feel for lots of different aspects of Spain here.
Yes.
I loved your reference to Sanchez in...
Yes, I know.
That's the benefit of reading some of those really old books too,
because yeah.
those things would just pass you by. You think, who's Sanchez?
Well, what's also fascinating, if we now look back at so many books we've written where a protagonist has a sidekick.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
you think, well, if indeed Don Quixote is one of the first
yeah.
novels or
yeah.
the first
yeah, yeah.
novel, maybe that is something
That's
that
right.
people, you
yeah.
know.
But I'm going to write a book about a sidekick.
Yeah.
yeah. So I decided for my second book to do one of my slightly foxed limited edition
how good.
Books. I get one every month.
Oh, isn't it pretty
as
well?
I'm falling behind and I've been dying to read this. So this is called As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning.
Oh, what a great title.
And it's by Laurie Lee and he's best known for his book Cider with Rosie.
Mm.
He was a British writer who lived from 1914 to 1997.
Oh, wow.
And he came from a small village called Slad in Gloucestershire. And Slad does not sound...
It doesn't, right. How's it spelt?
S-L-A-D.
Yeah. Weird.
Yeah. And when he was about 19, Laurie Lee headed off on foot and walked off on a trip. So I'm just going to read this tiny little bit from the beginning. He says, it was 1935. I was 19 years old, still soft at the edges, but with a confident belief in good fortune. I carried a small rolled-up tent, a violin in a blanket, a change of clothes, a tin of treacle biscuits, and some cheese. I was excited, vainglorious, knowing I had far to go, but not as yet how far. As I left home that morning and walked away from the sleeping village, it never occurred to me that others had done this before me.
How beautifully, what a good writer.
He's a beautiful writer.
He's
a beautiful writer.
Yeah.
It's a delight to read the whole thing. So he just decided to head off. He went first to London and then he decided to go to Spain, mainly because he'd had a Spanish girlfriend who taught him, can I please have a glass of water? That was all he knew in Spanish, but he thought, well, that'll do.
And I'm surprised it was water as well, just quietly.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that
it
your
was
priority?
It was something along those lines anyway, something very banal. And it was his one sentence. So he arrives in Spain in 1935, and of course we know that that was the year before the Spanish Civil War started. I think it was actually a bit more than a year, as in I think the war started during 1936. So he spends a year walking around Spain. So he basically, he does some labouring, particularly in London, he did some labouring. And then pretty much the rest of the time he's a busker with his fiddle, with his violin, which is not in a case, it's just wrapped up in a blanket. Yes. So you can see the level of simplicity. And there was not the thriving tourist industry that there is now. Often he was stared at as a complete stranger every time he arrived in a new village. Mm. Everyone knew that he was an outsider.
Yeah.
He only knew that one phrase in Spanish, so he had to work quite hard. It was really quite a hard trip, and it was pretty grueling. And he didn't have great shoes. He didn't have camping gear apart from his little, probably very basic tent back then. Mm. He had very little money except what he earned as a busker. And he knew not one single person in Spain. So he started off in Galicia and he sort of works his way gradually south, and it's quite a lot of fun. I kept pulling up my phone and sort of tracing where each town he went to. And he went to sort of different places from the places that I've been in Spain, and I kept thinking, why didn't he go over there? You know, it was quite fun. He recounts lots of great anecdotes about things that happen with different people he comes across, and boarding houses and sleeping under the stars and all the crazy people he meets along the way. So it's full of really great stories. And you get this sense of Spain then. It's a great snapshot of Spain. It's quite a rural, innocent sort of place, I think I would describe it. And each village is very separate from itself. It's not the global world that we know today.
They're quite unsophisticated.
It's a very different time, and I think this gives you a great insight.
But what a lovely, simple life, though.
Yeah, but also very hard.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you can romanticise all those elements of it, but it was equally terribly, terribly difficult at times. So, yeah, you know, like everything, there's two sides. And he ends up in a town which is actually called Almunicar, and I'm not probably pronouncing that correctly, which he gave a different name to in this book for, so he sort of wanted to give the town its privacy.
Yes.
He calls it Castillo. And I didn't know this, and I spent ages Googling Castillo. And so it took me a long time to discover an article about why he changed the name and all sorts of things. And then I had to go back and start all over again looking at this new town. And he gets to know the local fishermen and the labourers, and he sort of gets drawn in to the movement which is leading to the Civil War, which is just fascinating.
Yeah,
I can't even really imagine a civil war where people in one country rise up against each other, you know, like it's like the people in your suburb fighting against the people in my suburb. Yeah. I just can't even sort of imagine how that would work.
But you remember Jessica Mitford's husband?
Yes.
I mean, so many people from England.
All the brigades.
Yeah, came
out. The international brigades.
Yeah, they did. They all came out to Spain.
They felt very upset about Britain's position, which was non-involvement.
Yeah.
So Russia and one other country, I forget what, Russia in particular, really supported the populist movement and gave them guns and things. But a lot of countries like Great Britain did nothing.
Yes.
They sort of supported them in principle but wouldn't do anything to help. And that's why all these, the international brigades were massive.
And the labour movements.
You see all the photos of them all turning up to help.
Yes.
It's a fascinating story. And then you think the book's coming to an end. He's sort of in a town. He's in this place, which I'll call Castillo because that's the chapter of the book. And he's with a novelist, and he deliberately doesn't say the name because some of these people are subsequently famous. And he says, my friend, and you think, is that the woman that he was having an affair with who was married? And I'm not quite sure. There's all sorts of interesting things on the internet if you Google around. And all the villagers, a big destroyer comes into the harbour.
Oh, wow.
And, well, two things happen. First of all, another big destroyer comes into the harbour one night. It's the most fascinating story. And it just sits there very menacingly. And all the people are looking out to sea thinking, what is this boat doing? And it shines this huge big beam along the mountain, and it follows this jeep with these soldiers in it that, or, you know, these people with guns, follows them down the hill. And then there's this sudden boom.
Oh, no.
And nothing happens. And then the whole sky lights up and this boat has fired on the town and a house just dissolves in seconds and slides down the hill.
It's like a sort of equivalent of a mortar bomb.
People come running out and grabbing their children and running up the hill, terrified. And he is just struck. No one knows what to do. They think, what the hell, who is this? And then two men who he knows, who are his friends in the town, get in a little rowboat and row out to the boat and say, what the heck are you doing? Mm. And it turns out it's a boat on their side who's made a mistake and thinks it's the enemy and is firing on them.
So how brave, though, to go out in a row.
They rowed out there and they'd forgotten to take their guns. And so they row back. And so the boat says, oh, sorry, we made a mistake, and just sails off to the sunset. And no one really says anything more about it
because
it's the most amazing story. And that is just alone, it's worth reading the book for that story. And then a short time later, another big destroyer comes into the harbour, and then all of the locals come running up and knocking on the door and saying, you've got to come, you've got to come. The British are here to take you home. Pack all your stuff. And he realises that his year in Spain has come to an end. Uh-huh. And he goes down and there's a sort of a British, you know, the captain of the ship's down there, and he says, come on, chap, time to come home. We've come to take you home. And just sort of packs the novelist, and they're sort of basically picking up any stray
Brits
who are going to get stuck in this Spanish Civil War.
Excellent use of taxpayers' money.
It's a multi-million dollar vessel, and it's just pulled in just to get them. That is also a fascinating story.
Well, it's also fascinating in light of pandemics when we've left people stranded or other, you know, wars that are taking place and we've left people stranded.
Yep.
How fascinating.
They thought they'd pull in and see if there were any stray Brits that needed a lift home. So he ends up back at home, and it sort of causes him to reflect, and he thinks, I just can't leave those people. He's very much on the side of the populist movement. Mm. He's just become very attached to them. So he goes back and he goes in, I think it's via France from memory. Mm. That chapter is the most fascinating chapter. He goes back and it's all guarded. There are men at every checkpoint. Roads are all blocked off and everyone's saying, you can't come in. There's a war going on in Spain. No one can come in. Mm. I think the international brigades probably were an exception to that because they were probably legitimised and they were organised and they had vehicles brought stuff with them. But one little bloke with his sort of bag over his shoulder is not going to be allowed in. So he sort of hangs around in this town and thinks, how am I going to get back in there? So he says, I'm just going to have to climb the mountain. So he basically just heads off under cover of night one night and walks over the Pyrenees through snow and the most amazing things. And he's sort of on his hands and knees. It's like something out of a movie.
He's doing an Eric Newby.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Exactly like that, except it's midwinter and it's snowing.
Extraordinary.
And he sort of staggers into an area and some people find him in a town, and then they don't want to be getting into any trouble because people had to do things sort of undercover because the fascists would take revenge on them. So there was a lot of this sort of things said in pubs and I'll meet you around the corner and this sort of thing. Anyway, he got in and the book ends with him about to go off and fight in the war.
Wow.
And
you don't know
what happened next. I don't even know, actually. I haven't got to the point of discovering whether there's another recounting of the next chapter of his life. But I loved it.
Such a small book as well.
It's a little, but it's tiny print though. Look at
true.
It.
That's true. It does. But wow, it must pack a punch with all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, so it's sort of a travel memoir. It's a great snapshot in time about social mores and cultural mores. And I mean, what we think is acceptable to take with us traveling and what we think we would require to go traveling in another country versus what he had. And what he survived with.
We've all become very soft, though, haven't we?
We're so soft.
Yeah.
So that was As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning by Laurie Lee. It was completely delightful.
I love that, Jenny.
I loved it. And it really gave me a lovely flavour of Spain and lots of different parts of Spain. So it's sort of set, I think we're well set up now for reading.
Yes, I think we
reading,
are. I can't wait
Don Quixote
for Don Quixote.
Because we've sort of covered lots of different parts of it. So on that note, I thought I should just do a little reminder that we are doing our book club episode on Don Quixote, and we would love you to dig out a copy and read it. We're going to do the first half.
Yes.
Part one in one episode.
Mm.
And then we're going to do the second half in a subsequent episode.
And it will be a deep dive.
There will be a deep dive. So it's worth reading it along
yes.
with us. And I know some people are.
Yes.
And people have contacted me about editions and all sorts of things, which is great.
Mm.
As is not uncommon with us, we're a little bit, our timing has changed, shall I say, because I think we'd sort of thought we might do it in June and we're already well into June now. And life comes at you and things happen. And so the next few months might be a little bit unpredictable for the podcast.
Mm.
We're just going to have to do our episodes as and when we can because we've got a few other little adventures going on.
Mm.
So I actually can't say at this point exactly when we
yes.
will do record the next episode, but we'll do it as soon as we can.
Yes,
but
it might be
2 weeks, but it might be 3 or 4. I just don't know. And I'll certainly post about it on Instagram and keep you updated. And then we'll do the second half after that. So
perfect. Looking forward to it, though.
Yeah. And have you been diving into anything else?
Look, just bits and pieces. Not a lot, to be honest. I have started watching Peaky Blinders Series 6, which is the final series. The first episode of season 6 opened really quite poignantly because Helen McCroy, the British actress who...
Love her. She died.
She's died, yes. And so they open with her character, who is Aunt Polly.
That's right.
Dying, having been caught in the crossfire between the Peaky Blinders and some people who were trying to assassinate Oswald Mosley. So the era of Peaky Blinders has now moved into this pre-World War II era.
It's the same era that we've been talking
which
about.
Which is why I thought it would be quite interesting. Tommy Shelby, who is the head of the Shelby family, the Peaky Blinders, has become a Labour MP and he is courting very loose relations with Oswald Mosley, because it's beneficial to him, not because he likes him, he can't stand him. But what is interesting is that it's the first series in which we meet Mosley's mistress, Diana Guinness, Mitford. And I have to say they've taken a bit of license with Diana, in my opinion.
Okay. Oh, gosh, I'm going to have to watch
But it's really worth, really worth watching. So I've been really enjoying that.
How fabulous.
Yeah. And what about you?
I have been diving into a few things. One thing I really loved is a thing we watched called A Call to Spy. I've actually forgotten now where we saw it. But it centres around three young women involved in the French Resistance during World War II. And I love anything French Resistance. I think I would have loved to have been in that time, although I think I would have been too much of a chicken. But and one of them is located in Whitehall. And we've stayed in a hotel down near Whitehall. And I just spent the whole time walking around thinking, I wonder if Winston walked around these steps. You know, it's just fabulous.
Mm.
And she recruits young women to be telegraph operators and they go into France disguised. And the actress who plays one of the telegraph operators, the character's name is Virginia.
There you go.
And this actress researched and wrote the screenplay. She researched it for years, apparently. Mm. She's quite a distinctive-looking woman. And she plays a woman who has an amputated leg.
Mm.
So she has a very clunky wooden leg, which, as they did at that time. It's not like now.
Mm.
I don't know if that's what she really has, whether that was just cleverly done for the screenplay. But it was really, really gripping. And you didn't know who was a double agent.
Mm.
And Michael and I kept saying, do you think he's a double agent? Is he telling her the truth? Who's authorised this?
Yes.
I just loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I would recommend it if you like that sort of thing. So that's a Call to Spy. And the other thing I'm completely addicted to is The White Queen on Netflix.
Yes.
Which is all about Edward IV. And he leading up to the Princes in the Tower and Richard III. And I really didn't know a great deal about that time in history. I studied a lot of history, did modern history and ancient history, but I haven't really done the Tudors and all that sort of thing. And I've been reading books about it. This adaptation is really fabulous because it's reasonably true to the actual events. And the woman who plays Lady Elizabeth Grey, who marries King Edward, is so incredibly beautiful, which she was in real life. and he was so captivated by her and he sort of married her in secret and all that sort of thing.
It was a real love story, Lady Grey. It really was. Yeah. I remember it being a really...
It's very watchable. And he was he was said to be very handsome, and this one is. And then there's all the machinations with the two brothers and...
Yeah, it was very sad.
The War of the Roses. And so I just cannot tell you how much I have absolutely loved it.
Yes, okay. So the War of the Roses is Henry and Richard, isn't it?
The House of Gaunt. It's sort of coming through and Lancaster. Coming towards its end. So the Earl of Warwick is doing all his machinations, and then there's Prince... Richard and Prince George and the Neville sisters. It's just fabulous. And the other thing I am, although I'm actually a tad behind because we had a little holiday, but I'm also enjoying the podcast, The Teacher's Trial.
Oh, yes, I'm loving it. Oh.
Which is another Hedley Thomas podcast following the trial of Christopher Dawson, who's charged with murdering his wife, Lynn, 40 years ago.
And we are addicted to
Is it? Probably the most addicted people in Perth,
I would say. The genesis for our Murderinos group, isn't it?
It's completely how we became Murderinos. And I sort of worry that Hedley is going to say something that's going to abort the whole trial.
Yes, well, he's on notice, isn't he? He's been put on notice.
Yeah. Anyway, it sort of creates an extra frisson for me.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because I guess in true crime podcasts where... You know, you have these investigative journalists that are prepared to go the extra mile to try and find out why people died or where they are or they're lost. And then as a result of that, the police get involved. They wouldn't have got involved had it not been for the journalist's excellent investigative work.
Yeah.
And yet...
The criticism of
the idea that that could possibly prejudice a trial. It's this fine line,
isn't it?
It's
a very fine line. Yeah. But anyway, I'm absolutely glued to the entire thing. And, of course, I can remember little details from the podcast.
Yes.
And so when things are reported in the paper or said, I'm sort of...
Are you shouting at the newspaper?
I'm shouting at the newspaper on the podcast. But he said he saw her on Antiques Roadshow.
I know. I've been doing a bit of that as well. I actually underlined something in the paper the other day. I thought, that's not right. I did a big circle around it.
There was an allegation that the person who had the most to lose was X, and I'm thinking that's nonsense. Anyway,
We should be there, you know. We should be there for the trial.
I would so love to do that. In fact, don't start me because I've actually been thinking about... Yeah, that might be something to do.
So that's the delay of the podcast. Virginia's going to Sydney.
I'm busy. I'm sitting in the witness stand giving my two bobs worth about who did what. So that's it for us this time. We hope you enjoyed our little trip to Spain and around Spain.
I loved Spain.
That was fun. And we're really looking forward to diving into the first half of Don Quixote. I've made a start and I'm loving it.
Yes.
And I've sort of interrupted it and I've read a couple of other things. So my next thing is to go back and re-dive back into it in preparation. And we hope you'll join us.
We sure do.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Bye. We really enjoyed today's episode. Thank you for listening and thank you for all your lovely reviews too. If you want to know more about today's books or anything else we've talked about, you'll find them in the show notes. And we feature most of the books on our Instagram page too. At diving_in_podcast. And if you'd like to share any books that you've been diving into, we'd love to hear from you. Please email us at hello@divinginpodcast.com. Bye for now.
Breaking up, shaping up, working in, diving in. Breaking up, shaping up, working in, diving in.
A little bit of background checking over there.
No, I'm turning off someone who's ringing.
Oh, God. Okay. Sorry, I thought you were checking. What year was the Spanish Civil War?
I was not checking. I was turning my phone off because I had a call.